WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Wow, is what Fresh Air critic Maureen Cargan said after she finished the novel Possession by British author A.S. Byatt. Maureen wasn't the only one. Critics and readers loved the book when it came out last year. The vintage paperback edition is now available. Maureen described the book as part romance, part detective story, part fairy tale, academic farce, and gothic thriller. The novel is mostly about an illicit love affair between two Victorian poets. A century later, a young scholar named Roland Mitchell discovers the affair when he finds their love letters. Roland consults feminist scholar Maud Bailey, and together they begin a search for the real story. But Roland feels guilty about reading Ash's private letters. Byatt says she's been the object of literary detectives herself and thinks scholars should feel a little guilty.
I have become, as I have got more and more to the point where people actually do want to buy my notebooks, to the point of feeling some considerable hatred towards biographical explorers. Another thing, I was sitting in a seminar in University College talking about W.H. Auden, who destroyed a lot of things before he died and changed a lot of his poems before he died and destroyed some drafts. And one of my scholarly colleagues was in a terrible rage. He said he had no right to do this. And I said, what do you mean, no right? They were his. But that was the difference. I saw myself as a writer, and he saw himself as a person, a biographer, a scholar, a critic, whose duty it was to preserve these documents for the public. But he wasn't interested in the rights of the man who wrote them.
Is that what Possession is about?
It's one of the things Possession is about. It's about the way in which the biographer particularly, in a ghoulish way, at various points the biographers in the novel are called ghouls and scavengers and sort of hyenas, takes over people's lives. I think this was just beginning to happen in the 19th century, and George Eliot herself has a wonderful letter which I twist about and reuse in the novel about the awfulness of realizing that people had been through Dickens's desk and printed all those notes he thought was private. Though it's taken until now that Claire Tomlin has actually pieced together his love affair with Helen Ternan, because he hid it. But that you have to start hiding your life in strange ways, and this isn't good either.
I'd love to have you read a section from the book here, and this is on page 162, where Roland and Maud have a kind of encounter.
Ah, yes, this is a section where Roland and Maud meet outside a bathroom in a mock Gothic Victorian mansion in which they've discovered another cache of letters. And they're, one should say, hostile to each other. Maud has been very cold and chilly towards Roland. And Roland rather likes Maud, or would like her if she would unbend and be nice to him, but she won't. And he has been, they've both had to stay overnight because it's snowing. And he has been very, very careful to leave her the bathroom so that she can get washed in her privacy long enough. The whole story also is haunted by the image of the fairy Melusina, who was a fairy who was a woman above the waist and a serpent below the waist, and thus an image of sort of female androgyny. And she was discovered by her husband in a bathroom. He was told never to look at her on a Saturday, and one day when they'd been married enough to bring up 12 children, he did peer through the keyhole and saw that she was this, and then she had to leave him. So there's a game going on with bathrooms all through my novel. I think this is all I need to explain.
Okay.
When Roland came along the corridor in the silence, he thought he had been clever. The heavy latch door was dark inside its stone arch. There was no sound of plashing or flushing. He was then seized with doubt as to whether the bathroom was in fact empty. How could any sound penetrate that solid oak? He did not want to rattle a locked door and embarrass both her and himself. So he went down on one knee on the carpet and put his eye to the huge keyhole, which glinted at him, and disconcertingly vanished as the door swung back and he smelt wet freshness, steam in cold air. She nearly fell over him there. She put out a hand to steady herself on his shoulder, and he threw up a hand and clasped a narrow haunch under the silk of the kimono. And there it was, what Randolph Henry Ashe had called the kick galvanic, the stunning blow like that emitted by the moray eel from under its boulders to unsuspecting marine explorers. Roland got somehow on his feet, briefly clutching the silk and letting it go as though it stung. Her hands were pink and slightly damp. The fringes of the pale hair were damp, too. It was down, he saw the hair, running all over her shoulders and neck, swinging across her face, which he meekly supposed would be furious, and saw when he looked, was simply frightened. Did she simply emit the electric shock, he wondered, or did she also feel it? His body knew perfectly well that she felt it. He did not trust his body. I was looking if there was a light, so as not to disturb you, if you were in there. I see. The blue silk collar was dampish too. The whole thing appeared in this half-light to be running with water, all the runnels of silk twisted about her body by the fiercely efficient knot in which she had tied her sash. Below the silk hem were the ruffled, mundane edge of pink winsiette and slippered, sharp feet. I waited some time for you to use the bathroom, she said, conciliatory. So did I. No harm done, she said. No. She held out her wet hand. He took it and felt its chill and the subsidence of something. Good night, then, she said. Good night.
A.S. Byatt reading from her novel Possession. I love that passage, and I guess it's the attention to the detail, the tension. Here they are, two heady academics poring over love letters, and that galvanic or that kind of response.
Yes, I was pleased when I got that phrase into Randolph Ashe's little poem about the kick galvanic, because galvanic is a word that the Victorians used all over the place because they had just discovered that if you gave a dead frog an electric shock, it moved. Mm. And, of course, my whole thing is about bringing things to life with giving them shocks. So it works in all sorts of directions, that word. And at the same time, it is sort of purely romantic at one level, those two people touching each other and feeling a shock. And it is what does happen to people.
Well, there's something wonderful about even the looking through the keyhole.
It's a very ancient fairy tale motif. I mean, the number of stories of one kind and another there are of the prohibition against looking through the keyhole and then the person looking and immediately losing what he sees. And you think he would know. I mean, they're all in the same story and they all look through it and they all lose what they see. It's interesting. I mean, Freud explained it very simply. You know, what you mustn't do is look in on your parents making love. But I think it's more complicated than that. I don't quite know what it is. I just know that you tap deep into all sorts of people's primitive responses if you use that image.
I was interested to read that when you received the Booker Prize, which is a very well-known literary prize in England, that those ceremonies are televised. And it was shocking to me because I don't think we have anything where writers in this country, like an Academy Award, would receive prizes on television with an audience that watched.
It is actually, it is very beautifully orchestrated, the Booker. The name of the winner is kept a complete secret until it's announced at the end of the dinner. And various television companies have filmed the dinner in England. They also film discussions among critics, good and bad critics, about which book they think will win and about the nature of the four books. And they come to six books. And they come to the houses of the shortlisted writers and film them describing their book. And they've even done films of scenes from the books. And I think it actually works because it's done at a very primitive level, like a horse race. And it's got a narrative, and I don't think most of the viewing public are very interested in books, but they are interested in the agony that these six writers are going through, having to eat their dinner and not know which of them is going to go up and receive the prize. And it is, I can tell you now, I mean, it is extremely painful sitting there.
Well, you have to probably sit there and carry on a conversation with the person sitting next to you.
You do.
All the while wondering.
And every now and then the television cameras come and they make you extremely hot. And they watch you wondering. On the other hand, it is also fair to say that I do think that this kind of mixture of public discussion of literature and pure competitive sport has greatly raised the British interest in books and in writing. And people rush out and buy all the shortlisted books.
Why do you write, why do you call yourself A.S.?
I always meant to. There are two or three reasons. One is simply that when I started writing, I felt writers ought to be anonymous. T.S. Eliot said that poets were impersonal entities, and he wrote under T.S. Eliot, not under Tom. And he was a sort of hero, and I thought you could write under A.S. Byatt, and it has the same rhythm. I think, like George Eliot, I didn't want to get pigeonholed as a woman writer. But I didn't want to be thought to be a male writer. I just didn't want it to come into it. And then I also, when my eldest daughter was born, which was when I was very young, I got in a gloomy fit and I thought, Antonia is a very good name and I shall never now write a book because I am stuck in child rearing. So I gave her the name. And it is her name and she wishes, I think, probably to write. So I stay with my initials.
So you refer to yourself as A.S.?
Yes, and so she refers to me as A.S. And I mean, my friends call me all sorts of things. But if I'm doing radio, I mean, more in my own country, I'm very, very careful to remain with my initials, which is all I can do to sort of compensate her for this idiocy of having given her this rather good name.
Can you explain the family, your family, that produced two writers, you and your sister Margaret Drabble?
It produced, in fact, five writers. My father published two novels. My younger sister has published several very good books on art history. My brother wrote a volume of Halsbury's Laws of England. It was a family which was full of books. The house was full of books. It was, in a sense, narrowly bookish. Yeah. And ambitious, and both parents were ambitious, and I don't quite know why we all simply assumed we could do it. My mother, I think, could and would have written, but was a working-class woman who got as far as Cambridge University, which in her time was unknown on the whole for people like her. And I think she should have written, and sort of knew she should have done. And I think her ambition and her frustration got pushed on to the next generation. So this is a known thing that does happen. Ambitious and frustrated mothers produce even more ambitious and sometimes successful children. And I think it was that kind of paradigm.
In a New York Times Magazine profile of you, the author talked about, or you talked about, your mother's unhappiness, I guess, about being able to go to Cambridge, but not being able to be, I mean, coming home and taking care of children. Did you sense her unhappiness?
Yes, I did. I think we all did. She was very, very angry most of the time. And the times when she wasn't angry was when she gave you a poetry book and discussed a poem with you. Or the time when, for instance, I said to her, I think you would like to read Henry James. I was grown up by then, but she was still angry. And she read her way all the way through Henry James and got so excited, and the same with Proust. And then she was wonderful to be with. And so I concluded that despite her saying, you know, I love having had four children, I love having brought them up, she was actually very angry that she couldn't go on thinking about literature. It was bred into her.
Did you find then that writing and reading then was a haven in your household?
Yes, it was. It was A, approved of course, and B, it was a haven. And C, I was very ill most of my childhood with one thing and another. So I spent a lot of my childhood in bed with books. And nobody stopped me reading anything except 1984, which my mother said would depress me, which when I did read it, it did. But yes, it was partly a haven, but I think it wouldn't have been so good if it hadn't been a haven that I felt was also at some level approved of.
Yeah.
She liked to see us reading. I like to see my daughters reading, but they don't.
Mm. They don't?
Well, the eldest one does, the one who works for the Arts Council in London, but... And the middle one reads secretly, and the little one parades the fact that she never reads a book at all. She's going
rebellion.
To be a painter. Yes. Yes, she's a very intelligent reader when she does. Hmm. I've caught her out at it now and then.
A.S. Byatt's novel Possession is now available in paperback. This is Fresh Air.